seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
Hello, you're welcome along to Golf Weekly. We have in studio all the way from Spawell, the greatest driving range in Ireland and beyond, they say.
It's Peter a very Lowry. Wet one at the moment, Joe.
I'm sure it is.
We're hand-picking at the moment, so hence the putting on a bit of muscle.
You're hand-picking the balls.
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. But it has to be done.
Fair bit of time, doesn't it? It
certainly does.
Yeah. Peter Lowry in studio. Fionn Davenport is where?
I'm still in Orlando, where I'm going to be for the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. I'm currently in my Airbnb in downtown Orlando, to be more specific, Thornton Park. Very, very beautiful part of the city. Actually, the most beautiful part, along with Winter Park. Really lovely. Leafy suburb. Very nice. But they call it downtown.
I see you've been getting around, so we'll get to some tweets. There is so much to talk about, by the way. It's been a busy week in the world of golf. There's lots going on. You tweeted, brilliant round with friend of the pod David Ward and his brother-in-law John Carney at the Arnold Palmer designed Legends course at Orange Lake Golf Club. It was so much fun that the usual Golf Weekly rules around no direct eye contact were dispensed with.
Yes.
It was a brave move on your part, but you had a good time. So how did all this come about? You just got in touch on Twitter, was it?
So David Ward got in touch. He saw that I was in Orlando and he just, you know, said, listen, if you fancy playing around next week, we'd love to for you to join us. So I'd been down to Boca Raton for a couple of days down closer to Miami to visit friends. And so came up late and I said, you know what the hell, why not? So I went out 8:30 and myself, David, and his brother-in-law, John, who isn't a friend of the pod, but also, to be fair, is someone who just took up golf last year. But David can play. So I was watching him on the range before he went out and he was absolutely just flushing like four irons. And so I asked him, so what do you play off? And he was, oh, three, you know, out of Rogan's Town, but doesn't get a chance to play a lot of golf these days. Well, you'd never tell from the round he played because it was just gorgeous to watch. And more to the point, really good company, really, really enjoyable. We had a lot of fun. Big fans of yours, Joe, and you know, your broadcasting skills were commented on, but I have to say, all around really nice experience. And we played Orange Lake, the Legends course, which is designed by Arnold Palmer, and compared to the one that I played last week, it was so much nicer. Now, it wasn't fancy at all, but much like Mr. Palmer, wasn't the fanciest, but very, just a lovely course, really well designed. Each hole was well shaped and fairly memorable. And yeah, played well for 14 holes and then kind of just got a bit tired. But it was great fun, really good fun.
Very good.
Fionn, I don't know whether you can see it, but when you complimented Joe there, you want to see the smirk face that he had there.
I smirked because Peter started laughing and rolling his eyes at me.
It was wonderful. Oh, yeah. It really was.
You were a jackass, you know that? And your driving range stinks.
Thanks. And I'm a crap coach. And baddie, baddie, baddie.
Kevin Kinsella in touch to say, hey lads, this was all the way from the home of Lexi Thompson, which was the North Course at Fort Lauderdale Country Club with his father-in-law. Kevin says it's an amazing course. Have you played there?
No.
Okay. Alan Metcalf, lads, I just shared a flight home with Nathan Murphy from Birmingham. He's sitting down the back. TV's Craig Doyle is sitting up the front. Sorted out. That was my favourite tweet of the week, I have to say. Alan, I don't see the problem. Nothing to sort out from our perspective. Martin Shoiga, very much enjoyed Riviera. We'll get on to Riviera, but in short, it was brilliant. Sunday night in particular. Andy Creevy had a picture of Dustin Johnson being interviewed, as enthusiastic as ever. And it was a great photo of DJ barely holding the mic, just limp-wristed and not wanting to be there, as Rob Lee really tried to drum up some excitement. That's
tough. It's virtually impossible, isn't it, with DJ?
It really is. And Dave, a.k.a. Ned the Chief, wanted to know, have you stopped broadcasting live due to Peter's unpredictability? Yes, we have. There was a memo from several lawyers
right. Who
work for the company saying, we have Ivan Yates, we have serious live discussion on this. On this station, the biggest liability right now is Peter Lorre broadcasting live.
I feel like Peter Costas. Right now, I feel like Peter Costas.
Man of the hour. Man of the hour. Peter Costas.
We'll move on to him.
Yeah, let's get into the good stuff. Okay, so there are your tweets. At Golf Weekly OTB, get in touch. Send us pictures of you playing golf or on the tube or just with thoughts over what's going on. Or I think in particular, if you do spot Nathan Murphy down the back of a plane, that can become a new thing. What the hell was that, Fionn?
It's a horn out in the street. I don't know. I have no idea.
They're coming to get you.
The spoofology is over.
Where to start? Well, let's start with Peter Costas. This is Thursday. The WGC in Mexico is on. We are still, I think, enjoying Riviera, and we will talk about Riviera. But Peter Costas appeared on the No Laying Up podcast, which I think we've all become very big fans of. Do you listen to it, Peter?
I do, yes.
Yeah, it's good.
It is
good. They are funny. I don't often loll. I lolled in the car listening to it. Yeah. Not to Costas, to the lads.
To be honest with you, I was a little bit jealous that they got Peter Costas on.
Yeah.
You know, coming from our podcasts that we do.
Well, they got him.
Yeah.
Let's start with the headline stuff then, Fionn. Patrick Reed cheated 4 times. In some ways, I didn't find this the most interesting part of the interview.
No.
Get on to that, but it's certainly the headline news. He said, and obviously, for legal reasons, Peter, I know that's not something that you're terribly interested in, but Patrick Reed, I fully suspect, will deny this and will refute this and will have something to say about this. But Peter Costas is entitled to give his account of events. For those of you some people don't take any notice of these, of who Peter Costas is. He's worked for CBS Golf for 30-odd years, coaches Paul Casey as well, but ostensibly we all know him as a really brilliant, I think, golf commentator, sacked this year. I've seen Patrick Reed improve his lie up close and personal 4 times now, Costas said. It's the only time I ever shut Gary McCord up. He didn't know what to say when I said on air, well, the lie I saw originally, Gary, wouldn't have allowed for this shot. He goes on to say to No Laying Up, because he put 4 or 5 clubs behind the ball, you know, kind of faking whether he was going to hit this shot or that shot. And by the time he was done, he hit a freaking 3-wood out of there, which when I saw, it was a sand wedge layup originally.
Mm.
Already I've seen one of the examples at the Barclays being shared widely on YouTube and social media generally. Now, I must say, and I'm even starting to wonder, especially in my early years playing golf, the way he just put his club down behind the ball is something I see club golfers do all the time. Peter Lorre.
No.
I'm not saying it's not cheating, but I see it all the time.
You probably do see, you know, to a percentage of it. But like Peter Costas has been travelling the fairways, and we have to probably explain to everybody who Peter Costas is. I know you explained him as one of the greatest commentators.
Why are you undercutting me here?
I'm not undercutting you. But he's out on the golf course all the time. He's following the last group or the second last group every week.
Yeah.
So like he's gone up and looking at the lie and then commentating on what he sees.
Mm.
There's very few commentators. Majority of the commentators are in the box. So really only the people who really see it up close is the caddy and the player.
Yeah.
And like as you're saying, is club golfers put the club behind the ball and they push it down a little bit and hope for the best, you know. Mm. And they don't think there's anything wrong with this because the ball doesn't move. But it's improving their lie.
Mm.
I feel really strongly about this, and I felt it before when Patrick Reed was accused of. Do you like the way I just didn't jump in there? Accused of cheating.
Mm-hmm.
The PGA Tour have done very little about it, and now Peter Costas has come out, and he's another person that keeps on going down this line and saying this guy is a cheat. Now, what are we going to do about it?
Mm.
And the tour have done nothing about it.
Mm.
Absolutely nothing. And which is totally wrong. It's wrong on so many fronts. It's wrong for the guy who has finished 71st and missed a cut.
Mm-hmm.
It's wrong for the guy who has finished second when Peter Reed has won. To me, I feel gutted myself that when I look back on my career, I got beaten in 2 playoffs by a player who was sanctioned for cheating on the European Tour. And that's why I feel very strongly about it, because I could have been a multiple winner on tour, but I'm not. The Olympics, if you cheat in the Olympics, the medal goes to the if you're caught, it goes to the person and they get that accolade. But I'm not in that situation. So I feel really, really strongly about this.
I totally accept that. Just by the way, while we're on the Reid cheating story, and Fiona, I want to get your take on this as well, but Brooks Koepka equally, I mean, I don't know if Kostas and Koepka were in touch, I doubt it, but Koepka was doing an interview on Sirius Radio and he was asked about Patrick Reid, his Ryder Cup teammate, in the sand that time. This was before the Kostas claim. And he said of the sand infringement late last year, I don't know what he was doing. He was building sandcastles in the sand. And he went on to say, you know where your club is. I took 3 months off and I can promise you I know if I touch sand. If you look at the video, obviously he grazes the sand twice and then he still chops down on it. He went on to say about if you see people cheating on course. I haven't opened my mouth in the past, he means. I haven't opened my mouth. But if I saw it now, just because where I'm at in the game, the stature that I have, I would definitely say something. So building sandcastles was his point on Reid and what happened in the Bahamas. We don't need to revisit the Bahamas, Fionn, but on Peter's point here about Patrick Reid, I've seen Patrick Reid, in his opinion, cheat 4 times.
Yeah.
You know, people said at the Bahamas incident, it would be surprising potentially if that was the only time Reid in his career had ever cheated or improved a lie or made a mistake. Reid, again, to stress, said he unintentionally touched the sand. He did not know. So that was his recollection of that event. But this Kostas thing, Patrick Reid, this is going to be a huge, huge story. He's going to have to address this now.
It absolutely is. And without getting into the whys and wherefores, I find Reid's excuse barely credible. So we know we've already visited that. What's interesting is having read Brooks's comments where he, and I think the key part is this idea that somehow just because of where I'm at in the game, the stature that I have, I would definitely say something. Now, that's not just Koepka saying, you know, I am now one of the main names on the PGA Tour, therefore I'm duty bound. It's what, to me, what he seems to be implying is that I'm not just some junior player that the PGA can tell to shut up. And the reason why I say that is that because Cameron Smith, who, you know, most people might necessarily be familiar with, but he called out Reid. He's Australian, and he called out Reid. And he's just like a junior guy playing on the PGA Tour. And according to a report in Australia Golf Digest, he got a cautionary call from tour headquarters over what they said was a public attack on a fellow tour player. And I'm quoting here, according to a source, an official from the PGA Tour spoke to Smith about the remarks, essentially issuing a warning that he would be fined in the future if he made similar statements. Now, that to me, that's really worrying.
Yeah.
Because, first of all, Patrick Reid was sanctioned with a 2-shot penalty. So it's not as if these accusations are made in the blind. This accusation was made based on, well, I was going to say verifiable fact. And again, you know, the law suggests that Reid is entitled to a defense. But Cameron Smith called out Reid. And instead of the PGA addressing Reid, they address Cameron Smith.
Well, I was going to say that kind of actually. So what's the motivation behind that is a very interesting question on the PGA Tour's part. And that was an interesting point in the Peter Kostas discussion.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, the no laying up guys were kind of saying, well, you know, like, it's weird because in every other sport, controversy sells.
That's right.
So why are the PGA Tour so afraid of any kind of controversy? Why do they want to portray everybody as a great fella and absolutely obeys the rules? Kostas made the point that he thinks the future for this whole thing is centers around gambling, which is probably, to be fair, true of most sports. But he was saying, for instance, you know, very, very soon, the way we will watch golf is, and the example he used was Phil Mickelson tee shot, you can bet $50, will Phil hit the fairway? But so if there is any sense of cheating, then you're getting into very dicey territory if you want to envelope the whole thing in betting. Now, I kind of saw Costas's point in that, I have to say. I was like, yeah, fair enough, I get that. But I think the PGA Tour have been going after this policy of portraying everybody as a great person even long before, I think, betting and that market came into their heads. I think that's been a policy for a long time.
It has. And it is worth pointing out that golf is, for the most part, a self-regulating game. Mm. You know, that, you know, 99% of all golf games ever played don't have referees, don't have umpires walking along checking. So you have to check it yourself. And that spirit is brought into the professional ranks, even though, you know, there's 42 television cameras watching every shot. Although Peter Costas really does put to bed the idea that modern television is doing a bang up job for money reasons. But what struck me was interesting, and this perhaps plays into Peter's original point about feeling that he was hard done by, is that every generation, and going back to when I was young, there was, like, I remember in the 90s, Nick Price, Ben Crenshaw, and Tom Watson all made elliptical comments about cheating in the game. They all said at different times around the mid-90s, if I'm not mistaken, Peter, you might remember it more accurately, made different comments without naming names, but basically saying, listen, we know who they are. We know it happens. We know who they are. Peter Costas was at pains to point out, he kind of said, look, there's always been a player or two throughout history, and I'm quoting him directly. And now, I remember Tom Watson in 1995 maybe saying, he goes, look, the game is a game of integrity, but you're talking about money and you're talking about livelihoods. So this idea that golf has cheaters, thankfully there's only maybe one or two. But even as back as the 90s, people were reluctant to say, point a finger and say, you're the cheat. You're the guy cheating. I've seen you improve a lie. I've seen you, like, I can't remember who it was. There was like a young Scottish player was banned for like 1,000 years for playing a ball from a different position. Mm. But he was a young player. He wasn't an established tour pro. So the problems, so this idea that the senior figures of the game, your Crenshaws, your Watsons, your Prices, could make statements back in the 90s, but did not feel comfortable enough to kind of name and shame, it's still exactly the same today.
Yeah.
Well, but with one caveat, yeah. I think Brooks Koepka is actually moving that dial. I think Brooks Koepka saying, look, he's not straight out calling Patrick Reed a cheat, but by saying, look, I don't know what the hell he was doing there, but he's building sandcastles.
Yeah.
And he goes, and being in the position that I'm in, four-time major winner, you know, a major player on the PGA Tour, I now feel emboldened enough to say, come at me if you want, PGA Tour. Come at me if you want, Commissioner. I am going to name it. When I see it, I'm going to name it. And I think that that's why it's not even about Patrick Reed. It's about something even bigger than Patrick Reed. It's about saying, okay, enough of this bullshit. I've had enough. If I see it, I'm going to name it.
Yeah. I take the Costas betting point to a point, and that's part of the PGA Tour motivation. But it is a wider thing. I mean, you can get done for cocaine on tour, test positive for cocaine, and unless they've changed this rule very recently, I'm not sure they have, the PGA Tour won't reveal that. An example of that, by the way, on CBS, he said, I think the tour had an issue with me not being a cheerleader. So Costas is of the opinion that CBS getting rid of him has a lot to do with the PGA Tour, and the CBS television deal is up either this year or next year, and they're trying to renegotiate. So obviously the PGA Tour's opinion on CBS panelists, you would think, is important. So he gave an example, for instance, about interview. You know, Costas used to always do the interviews on the 18th green with the winner, and there was a first-time winner on tour, and Costas basically went up to him and said, you know, how does it feel? You now have 2 years job security and you're going to the Masters, which in his opinion is clearly what the young player was thinking about.
Everybody think yeah. that way. I think that way, no matter who they are.
So Costa says to the No Lane Up guys, that was roughly my question. And then I got a phone call the next day from New York. They had gotten a call from the commissioner, and the commissioner was upset that I didn't say, first off, that he had won 500 FedEx points and he didn't want me talking about the majors. So Costa said, come on. And he didn't listen to that directive. And eventually he was just replaced as the person interviewing the winners on Sunday. So that's an example of the extent to which CBS coverage is controlled by the tour, which was a really interesting insight, you know, that it's that hands-on.
Can I add a caveat here? Look, like you guys, I thought Costas was brilliant on the pod. I thought he was articulate. I thought he was informative. And he didn't come across at all bitter, I didn't think. Mm. Clearly a man who didn't take well to being fired after all these years with Gary McCord. But can I just, maybe devil's advocate. I mean, it is also, maybe CBS do have a point in that they want to reinvigorate their coverage. Like McCord and Costas have been doing this for a very long time. They've got Amanda there. They've got Trevor Immelman was on broadcasting duty. They've brought in Michelle Wee. I mean, there is a sense of kind of bringing in new blood as well. So
they did replace him with Davis Love III, though, who by all accounts is no good.
Yeah, and that's perhaps, yeah, there's
real, that was a real shot of adrenaline into the coverage.
What I'm saying is that, like, all I'm saying is that whilst I'm certainly not disbelieving Peter Costas, but he mightn't necessarily be the most trustworthy eyewitness to what CBS's thinking is, because, you know, he's been directly hurt by them. So, and I'm not disputing anything Costa said. I'm just saying is that, like, maybe the coverage did need a bit of freshening up. Maybe it needed more female voices. I know Dottie Pepper has now been promoted. Mm. Frank Nobilo is now full-time. As I said, they've brought in Michelle Wee. I'd like to hear from Michelle Wee.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
I think she could offer a huge amount. She's younger, she's female. And I think that maybe CBS are reacting to demographic shifts in their audiences, you know, I mean, or they're looking to appeal to broaden out that appeal. I mean, I would imagine that if you sat in a CBS senior production meeting, you would get a whole bunch of other explanations as to why the contracts of McCord and Costas weren't renewed for 2020.
Yeah.
Which isn't to say that Costas doesn't have a point. I did want to say, and it's not just because I'm kind of harking back to old cheating things, but just to kind of show that this is an issue that's been kind of in the game for a long time. I asked Peter if you remembered the 1991 Ryder Cup at Kiwer Island, which I think is the first Ryder Cup that I really do remember. And on the foursomes on the first day, okay, so Chip Beck and Paul Azinger were playing Olathabal and Seve. And they broke the one ball rule. So you have to play with the one ball on the hole. They changed the ball mid-hole for a different compression ball. And Seve afterwards called him out. Paul Azinger denied it at first. He goes, no, that's not true. It didn't happen. But because Ali and Seve didn't report it until after the ninth, there could be no penalty. So no penalty could be adjudicated to Beck and Azinger. After which, as soon as Azinger found out, he changed the story. He goes, okay, yeah, we did change it. Now, like, I mean, to think, like, and this is meant to be in the days before the high-pressure world of modern golf with millions of dollars on the line. And, like, Paul Azinger and Chip Beck are actually breaking the rules in full knowledge of what that rule is. Mm. But then Paul Azinger counts and goes, listen, Seve can say all he wants, but this guy coughed his way through our shots. Now, you know, Seve did have a reputation for that. And even Olathabal said, yeah, no, Seve did do a lot of coughing. Now, in fairness, he was also coughing when they weren't playing shots, as in Seve wasn't feeling very well. But my point is this. Golf, it goes, there has been the breaking of rules in golf. And the authorities of golf just seem so paralyzed, like a deer in the headlights, and how to address this effectively. And they kind of end up neither leaning one way or the other. So Costas's or the no laying up guys point about, like, look, the NBA, football, baseball, you know, a bit of controversy, like, really sells the game. Or the game is super, super clean and nobody ever breaks the rules. Now, neither of those things are true, and the PGA can't seem to lean one way or the other. They're pretending that one way is real when it isn't, but they absolutely refuse to kind of say, okay, we're going to lean in. We're going to sanction cheaters and create scandal and all the rest of it. But guess what? It'll make the game, I don't know, more talked about. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, I find the whole thing just perplexing.
Yeah. Let's move on to Riviera then. So Adam Scott prevailed. He won the Australian PGA Championship back in December. He took some time off. This was his first tournament back, and he broke his near four-year PGA drought. Held off an excellent field, 9 of the world's top 10. Adam Scott is now back in the world's top 10, aged 40. Paul McGinley, who was on the show this week, will play out the McGinley interview looking back on Riviera. He mentioned you playing with a young Adam Scott. I don't know if you remember this, but he remembered you coming off the course saying, I've just played with the next, can't remember the exact word, but big deal anyway. Do you remember that? Is that ring a bell? No?
No, it doesn't. Okay. Well, my memory's dreadful anyway.
Yeah, well, he remembered you walking off going, I've just played with this young Australian kid.
Right.
Watch out, everybody. So anyway, Scott, here he is at 40 with just one major to his name. I was like, from his point of view, it's a really good win.
Fabulous. Look, I really like Adam Scott. I like the way he plays. He's a very nice guy to talk to. I have to say one thing though, what got me watching the coverage the other night, and you see Rory struggle with the putter a little bit and other people, and you watch Scott with the long putter and you think to yourself, was that not banned? And
but he's not anchoring.
I never once mentioned was it anchoring? I just think, was that putter not banned? Was the long putter, the way he's using it, not banned? And you see, Langer still uses it.
Clearly it wasn't, because he's not anchoring.
Yeah.
Look, it just takes something from it, for me, whilst watching it. As a golf, I wouldn't say purist, but I love golf.
Mm-hmm. What would you change the rule to?
Your putter has to be the shortest club in the bag. Mm-hmm. You know, that was supposedly going to be the rule, and then they just couldn't do it, or they didn't do it at the time.
When did long putters first come in the scene? Has there not been a long, if we're talking about traditions, has there not been a long tradition of long putters?
Cheekers, I don't know when they came out.
Long time though.
Fionn, any ideas?
No idea. I mean, that's not true. Do I remember a long putter in the 90s? No, maybe, I could be wrong.
Was Roger Davis probably one of the earliest ones of it? He held it on his chin, didn't he? Probably hold everything too. It takes something from it for me.
Okay.
But I have
Johnny
to say,
Miller was the first pro to use the long putter. So it goes back to the 80s.
Right. I just don't like it. I don't like where it is. I don't like he's able to practice it with it anchoring, and then he moves it off a couple of inches, if even a couple of inches. I firmly believe that, you know, you have to have two hands on the putter and away you go. And if you're no good with the putter, you're no good. It killed a lot of players over the years that couldn't putt properly, mm-hmm. you know, and they just disappeared into the ether.
Uh-huh. Peter, can I counter that argument for a second?
Yeah.
Okay. Now, and obviously, look, I'm going to bow to your greater knowledge of the golf swing and the putting stroke, but they banned anchoring for a specific reason, is that anchoring gave an undue, or they felt that it gave an undue advantage to those with putting struggles, usually the yips, because it allowed them to kind of take that kind of forearm muscle out of it. So you just move the body and all you are is just like you're holding the putter in place. By taking the anchoring away, and you know, even taking your point that, so Adam Scott is holding that long putter, and even if you had to take it 2 inches from your chest, it brings those muscles back into play. And so all of a sudden,
not to the same extent. We're talking very averages here, you know, very minute detail of how much he's away from his chest.
Sure. But in
my eyes, it's wrong.
Okay, but
in my eyes, that Langer and Adam Scott using a long putter like that, it's against the rules.
But if Adam Scott was a serial winner since the anchoring ban was introduced and was like leading the putting stats or had, more accurately, putting stats that were the same as or better than the putting stats he had before the anchoring ban was introduced, then maybe I'd say, oh, there's a point there. But his game, like this is a guy who doesn't win that much. And I'm assuming
he doesn't play that much.
Okay, but he's had unbelievable putting woes. So it's not as if like...
Oh, he has. Yeah, he's not very good. He's not very good with the putter, with the long one or the short one. He's not. His putting is not his strong point. Whether it's
no, I mean
short.
His ball striking, his swing
is a copycat of what Tiger Woods was when he worked with Butch Harmon, because Adam Scott and Tiger worked together with Butch Harmon at the same time, because I remember the story going that Butch Harmon went to Tiger and said, "Do you mind if I work with this young kid?" And his swing then replicated Woods is in whatever that was in the early 90s.
Well, Joe, what's your take? I'm curious as to what you think, Joe.
I mean, I get your point about it going against the spirit of the rule change. It's hard to argue against that. But technically, he's breaking no rules. It's within the power of the RNA and the USGA to simply say that whole anchoring rule, we're going to change that to the putter has to be the shortest club in the bag. They could change that rule overnight.
They can. They are the worst for changing rules.
Sure, but they could, is my point. And so, whilst I see where you're coming from, instinctively to me, when you were making that point, especially when Adam Scott has just won, I felt this is unfair on Scott to be talking like this. He's breaking no rule. He's up front and centre what he's doing. I guarantee you there are people sitting at home zooming in to make sure if he even anchors it once, they'll be emailing into the PGA Tour to say, gotcha. And so for me, if somebody is very clearly applying themselves within the letter of the law, I don't know if it's right to say what he's doing is wrong. I think you can say the rule is wrong for sure, and I would accept that. But I think... to almost throw a shade over Adam Scott, who I, as you said, and you know him, you say he's a great guy, exemplary guy, I feel it's unfair.
No, I think if you go back and listen to what I said, I just said that it to me, I'm very uncomfortable with it.
You said it's wrong.
To me, it's wrong.
Yeah.
In my personal opinion.
The rule is wrong.
The rule is wrong.
But Adam Scott's doing absolutely nothing wrong.
No, he's doing nothing wrong.
And I suspect if the rule changed in the morning, he'd try and adapt and find a way and might win a couple of more times. Mm.
He tried to go to the long, to the short putter.
It didn't work out
well, for sure.
Yeah. So is the existence of the rule, though, I mean, in part, it's because golf is a peculiar game with an awful lot of longevity. So, I mean, as we all accept, your putting disintegrates over the course of time. So the putting stroke you had at 22 is not the putting stroke you had at 38. It just isn't. And I would say it's rarer than a hen's tooth to find a putter or a golfer who is better at putting at the age of 38 than he or she was at 22. So that failed, you know, the kind of more harsh, okay, we're going to make the putter the shortest club in the bag, which means that fundamentally you have to adopt a more traditional putting stroke. Now you have three options. You can claw it, you can have your standard kind of right hand down or left hand down. Is it not to protect and say, is because otherwise what you're saying is to any player, and I include Tiger Woods in this, even though Tiger Woods' putting stroke is the same as it ever was, his putting stats just aren't as good. But you're saying to a player over the age of whatever, 35, 40, you're saying, well, guess what? We're now going to change the rules and your chances of winning have just gotten 1,000% harder.
Yeah, maybe that's the point. I'm thinking about this on the fly, right? Because I just hadn't anticipated this conversation, trying to work out exactly what I think. If we go back to when this rule came in, it was because the likes of Webb Simpson and Keegan Bradley and others were profiting, it seemed, disproportionately. For the number of long putters in the game, they were winning a fair few too many majors. Mm. And they weren't the caliber of player that suggested they should be winning.
Tim Clark was another.
Correct. And so it was at that time, I do remember thinking, this is interesting. There is something in this, and we're going to see potentially. I felt we were on the precipice of some kind of mass migration over to the long putter. I felt like in practice, I suspect a lot of players were playing around with it and saying to themselves, "There is something in this. I'm making this move."
There was a huge mass moved over to the anchoring part of it. Remember the belly putters?
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
So that was the problem, and the rules people looked at it and they said, "Well, the issue maybe actually isn't the length of putter. it's the anchoring. And so they said, let's attack the anchoring. And that prompted the majority of those guys, Webb Simpson certainly, Keegan Bradley's been back and forth a bit, Scott's gone back and forth a bit, but it prompted a lot of those guys to stick with the shorter putter.
It destroyed people's careers. Tim Correct. Clark, yeah. It destroyed. Okay.
So then where we are now is, Scott is one of a minority who has a longer putter. We're not seeing guys with longer putters suddenly cleaning up in the majors the way we were around the time the ban came in. Scott has managed to win, yes, on this week. I understand it's the purest argument, and look, traditionally the putter should be the shortest club in the bag. But if we're looking at the rationale for the rule to come in, it was that there was a disproportionate number of these guys winning. So I don't think it's fair when, on occasion, as is going to happen, especially if your game's as good as Adam Scott, when Scott wins using the long putter, I don't think it's fair to go, don't like it. Because he's not one of a cohort who are winning, and you can't point at the longer putter and say, that's why.
Okay, well, he's won the last 2 weeks that he's played.
Fine. He's good enough to win the Australian PGA with my putter in his bag. Okay?
He will not win a golf tournament with a short putter.
Maybe not, but is it a disproportionate advantage? And I would argue, based on the overall picture of golf at the moment, it's not. Does someone like Scott really like that longer putter? Yes. Is that any more egregious than somebody who really likes a certain type of driver? Probably a touch more, because it goes against the traditions of the game, but I'm not sure it's in the same ballpark as what the way you're portraying it. I've had time to think about it now, and that's my opinion. Where in the rules
of golf does it say ever that the putter should have been the shortest club in the bag? Where? No.
I don't know, but it was always the tradition.
That's what I was saying. That's what they were going to bring in. That was the rule that was talked about to stop the anchoring. Was, you know, the putter had to be the shortest club in the bag.
But golf, like, Peter, I absolutely understand the point you're making.
Yeah, so do I.
Absolutely. But in golf, they talk about tradition. They just chuck that word around, tradition. Like the Masters, the tradition of the Masters. It's like the Masters was founded in the 30s, not the 1500s. It's like,
We're getting off topic there a bit.
I realize we're getting animated about this.
We got to move on a bit as well. I must hold my hands up and say, I don't listen to what you're saying and think you're way off here. Like, I get it. And there's probably an element of this as well, whereby if Patrick Reed was one of the main proponents of the long putter and he had just won at Riviera and you'd said this, part of me might be sitting there going, you know what, Peter, you're dead on. But Adam Scott just seems like one of the best exemplars of all the right things around the game. And so maybe that's part of my thinking here as well. I would have to concede.
Okay.
So it's to your credit that you, who know this guy and like this guy, are calling it out. Like, I'm full of admiration for you to do that.
I'm calling it out just, it's my own personal view of the way I see golf, right? And the way I see golf is, when Bernard Langer wins on the seniors tour, I go... You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It means nothing to me. When Adam Scott was in the final group against the two lads, Rory and...
Kuchar.
Harold Varner.
Oh, was it Varner? On the weekend.
On the weekend, yeah.
Sorry.
Kuchar, wasn't it in the last round?
Oh, sorry, Kuchar in the last group.
You know, people were asking me, who was I going to put money on? And I said, well, I hope Rory, you know, he turns up. But I'd have to be wary of Adam Scott. Because of his ball striking, and he likes it around Riviera.
Yeah.
And when he won, you know, I'm happy for Adam. But when you ask me about the thing and when I watched it, that's what goes through my head.
I think if you remember, I asked you, that's a good win for Adam Scott. Yeah. And you wouldn't even admit that.
No, it is a good win. And don't get me wrong. And I was disappointed that Rory didn't play well enough on the final round to get a win.
In fairness to you, nobody else I heard made that point all week, and you could have easily avoided making the point, so I think it's to your credit that you did. Look, on balance, the easiest way to solve the problem is to just bring in the clean rule of the putter has to be short. It's hard to argue against that. Maybe I'm part rebelling against the fact that let's let Adam Scott enjoy this week. Fionn, would you have the putter under a certain length, or is the current situation okay?
It goes back to something you said. I understand the rule. You know, yeah, if they do, I'm not going to go, oh my God, that's so unfair, that's so wrong. Mm. But the fact that they haven't, I'm okay with the logic, precisely because, like, the putting stroke was the issue when it was jammed up either into your belly or up against your chest. And the fact that you have to stroke it, it doesn't, although despite my animated tone, it doesn't exercise me that much. But although, mind you, Joe, you do make a good point. If it was Patrick Reed playing and had won with a long putter, maybe I wouldn't be so generous.
Yeah.
So maybe there is an element that I actually just like Adam Scott, and there's a part of me who's like, yay, Adam Scott won, that's good.
I've told my hands up. I think that's part of my thinking as well. Mm. Yeah. You said you hoped Rory would turn up.
I did,
so,
yeah.
World number one, and he deserves immense credit for that. Since Portrush, he has played 12 events. He has had 10 top 10s. He has had 8 top 5s. He has had 2 wins. He is just a joy to watch, and he has been phenomenal for a long time now. So we get to the fifth hole, triple bogey 7. It was a really interesting contrast to have him and Scott, who went long. Rory said he caught a flyer and upturned saucer. They both failed just to get it back on. It's a tough shot. Like the amateur more than you, Peter, can totally sympathize with that, yeah, one being tricky.
No matter what it was a tough shot. Yeah.
They both get it back on. Rory to 20 feet. You think, okay, it's a double bogey. That's painful. The really interesting analysis is from that point on, when he rolls it up to 2 feet 11 inches and misses that putt. Echoes a Portrush, actually, where he missed a short putt.
Yeah.
And then Scott goes on to the next hole. Scott makes the 6, Rory makes the 7. Scott goes on to the next hole, makes a birdie. Now, that's a hell of a birdie on that par 3, but it's a hell of a birdie. And Rory makes a bogey. So that's a 3-shot swing with the ultimate winner.
Yeah.
Now, I feel somewhat chastened talking about Rory because I ended up in the newspaper being played to him, and that's not like my full and complete view of Rory McIlroy, so I almost a bit embarrassed that segment of that weekend gets played to him, because it's not my full and complete view of him. But
his team listens to this show.
Grant, well then they will know in the main I'm 99% just in awe of the guy, and he's the most interesting golfer just below Tiger on the planet, so you know, I just think he's great. But I'm not doing my job if we don't analyse those moments. So that 2-foot putt from 2-foot 11 inches putt and the bogey, that is the heart of what we're talking about here. Now, Rory said afterwards, look, I played really well. For the other 17 holes, I think he was 1 under, which he was.
Yeah.
But we're talking about crucial moments here. In your opinion, and we're judging from afar, is that pressure getting to him a bit, even though you would hate to admit that? Is that carelessness? Although I think if you've made a 7, you're probably not going to be careless on the next hole. You know, you pull up your socks a bit. What was your reading of that from afar without being in his head?
I just think the mistake was going over the back of the green, you know.
And he said he got a flyer there.
And that was more than anything. Mm. When he saw Scott go over the back of the green, and, you know, it wasn't a match play situation, because they were all very close to the, you know, they were all very close at the time. He was playing against Kuchar and Harold Varden and whoever else. So, okay, he got a bit unlucky to go over the back of the green. Now, do you take your punishment and not be... Both of them were tried to play too smart, tried to get it too close and, you know, not accept 5. Mm. And unfortunately, you know, they made 6s and 7s of it. I don't think we can say it's lack of concentration. I don't think it was pressure.
When you missed a putt from 2-3 feet, what did it tend to be?
I moved on it.
And what was that as a result of? Pressure, lack of concentration, another?
Probably wanting to know the result before it happened.
Okay.
So I would move out of it. I would lift my head slightly. Mm. I wouldn't say it's pressure, it's more anxiety. Is anxiety and pressure the same thing?
Same ballpark, I would
say. Same ballpark. Yeah. But no, I can't see it being pressure, to be honest with you.
Okay, that's interesting. Because the tournament was there for him to win, wasn't it?
It certainly was, yeah. Yeah.
Fionn, you're reading a Sunday, which was brilliant, by the way. It was a great, great Sunday.
Yeah, it was. It was amazing. Can I just say, there's something, it's the double bogey Rory made at Portrush that always rankled with me far more than the OB on the first.
And him as well, I think, actually, in some respects.
Yeah, and yeah, because like before I heard Rory's interview, that like the OB, which people have talked about ad nauseum since last July, was just, wasn't the worst shot in the world. It just went a bit, you know, went a bit more left than he'd hoped for. But the double bogey, I don't know what it is. And you used all the words that have come into my head since Sunday. Is it a bit of lack of concentration? Is it maybe all of a sudden you've got a seven on the card and it just takes you a little bit longer to get back into that kind of clean mind, that blue sky zone that you need to play? It's also worth pointing out that Rory played immaculately for 71 holes. Mm-hmm. Like, he was brilliant. Mm. Like, on an unbelievably tough track that punished a lot of players, a lot of very, very good players, Rory played brilliantly for 71 holes. And so I'm counting kind of the two holes, the fifth and sixth, as one little moment. And then just played awful on that one, went long, missed that three-footer. Golf is tough. Golf is hard. Golf is cruel.
Yeah.
This guy, there is nothing to detract from the absolute confidence we have that having reached number one, he's going to be number one for a very long time. His game is in amazing shape.
Yeah.
You know, and so you can make one mistake and just move on. And you didn't win. Okay. I don't know. I think I know it's not a very kind of media-friendly take to say is this like no big deal. But my ultimate thought is no big deal.
Yeah. And they're the two ones we're grappling with. You know, there's an interesting point that I think I'm more in your camp on this one because he's playing so well and has been for so long and because he's won events as well. But yeah. If it was some kind of pressure, for instance, it's fresh in my mind because Ronan O'Gara was doing the Virgin TV coverage with me for the Six Nations. And it's on my Twitter feed if you want to watch it. And even if you're not a rugby fan, it's a fascinating insight into pressure. And he made the point that early on in his career, he played in a Heineken Cup final and he had five kicks against Northampton and he missed all of them. All of them, 0 for 5. Mm-hmm. And his point was, I had two choices then. I could have brushed that under the carpet because he said, really, real pressure that you really feel only comes on a handful of times across the season. So you can still have a fantastic career and kick really well and not address it. And he said, I had to address it. I had to break it down and say, why did that happen?
Mm.
And that was a really interesting insight for a fella who we later associated with adoring pressure. So I'm interested, I'd love to know, will Rory look at what happened on the 5th and say to himself, ugh, one of those things. And he may be right. Or will he say to himself, that was at the peak moment of pressure in that tournament. Let's strip that back. What happened there? Where, what was I thinking? Why did that happen? Because he may not feel pressure like that again until Sunday at Augusta or another major. Now, I know the first thing he would scream is, and he said it to Paul Kimmage, I don't feel that kind of major pressure at normal routine PGA Tour events. But I still feel Riviera, big tournament, you're world number one. I think on that front nine on Sunday, he couldn't have been immune to pressure. You know, I'm not saying it was a major pressure necessarily, but I feel like pressure was part of that story. If he had made that mistake on a Thursday at Riviera, I would have been less inclined to think of the O'Gara thing. But it's in my head. It's just, you know, pressure will come on somebody of McIlroy's caliber 5 times, 6 times a season. Real in the heat of it pressure because he's so comfortable in so many routine events and so many of those routine events will not define his career the way majors will. Now, I don't know the answer. It was a thought I had. And I guess we'll find out at the big moments across the next couple of years.
I think we can compare, well, we can't compare him, but let's put Tiger Woods in that situation. In his heyday, what was the result?
A 6. 5 or 6.
No, sorry, what was the end result? The end result was Tiger would win.
Sure.
Being in that position, going out on a Sunday, he very rarely threw away a golf tournament. Because he's won 83 times. And that's where we have to look at it. So Rory, going on Paul Kimmage's article, will sit on the plane or sit on the car on the way home and write in his little black book what mistakes he made and what mental errors he made.
Mm.
Because really at this stage now, Rory's game, as Fionn says, is in spectacular position. Or, you know, as we see it from the outside, he mightn't feel it being that way. He mightn't feel that he has his swing is in a perfect position, but it certainly looks that way.
It does look great, yeah.
His ball striking is good. His distance control is good. And he actually is putting and chipping the ball a whole lot better than he used to do. So it can only be mental, and whether he made a mental error over that 2 foot 11 inches, whether he wasn't focused on that putt whilst his mind was thinking, you know, why did I hit my second shot over the green and why have I got this putt now and bloody, bloody about whatever goes, you know, all the other things that go through your mind at that position. And he'll have to write that in his book, and he'll have to learn from that himself. But we as now, you know, hurlers on the ditch can say, you know, where we think he made a mistake. And, you know, the only mistake you can say, it's not the two footer. It's maybe the fairway miss where he got the flyer rather than the actual flyer. So we work it backwards and say, you know, well, why did he miss the fairway?
And that can just happen. It's a tough course.
Exactly. Fair.
I think.
Rory.
I mean, the idea. Look, Tiger wouldn't have missed a 3 footer. We know that Tiger in his pomp would never have missed that 3 footer. But Rory has alluded to this without specifically saying this, is that he's okay with not being Tiger.
Yeah.
That the cost of being and also Tiger is a once in a century talent. He's a once in a century kind of, or maybe two in a century, him, Nicklaus. Rory isn't Tiger. And he has spent years kind of dispelling the notion that, like, oh, I'm the next Tiger, or I'm like Tiger. He's made a point. He goes, look, whatever Tiger, the way Tiger's done his thing is the way he's done his thing. This is how I live. And if losing Riviera, and I use the air quotes, if missing out on Riviera is the cost of having the life that Rory lives, I think Rory is perfectly comfortable with that. I think he's absolutely fine. However, having said that, I think Peter's absolutely right. Given that last week we were so interested in Rory talking about all the books he's reading about psychology and about all of these kind of sporting issues, I would not be at all be surprised if Rory kind of sat down and kind of coldly analyzed, okay, what happened there? Okay, what can I bring to the next tournament so that doesn't happen again? And let's all move on.
Yeah, ultimately, he's in a great place. And Augusta can't really come quick enough, I think, this very form that he's in.
Not old Tiger, though.
Oh, Tiger, yeah. How tired did Tiger look on Sunday night? He was like, there was one swing where he just didn't even turn his body, it was just arms, and it just shot off to the right. It's like, I can't even believe what I'm seeing here. Because like traditionally, Tiger would, if he was in 25th and there was a chance to get to 18th, even though it made no difference to anything, he would just
now
find a way
totally
to do it.
Different.
Now he was just wrecked.
He doesn't care.
He was so tired.
It's like his mind turns off, doesn't it? And the body just...
He did a very interesting, he looked, when I saw him, he looked incredibly slim, you know, and it was very interesting. He did an interview with Henny Zuhl for Golf TV afterwards, and he was saying that he's far too light at the moment.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well.
So the first thing he's going to do is get back in and try and put on some weight because he felt tired and light. And he was saying that's not as easy as it sounds for him because he eats a lot. He's just got an unbelievable metabolism, bastard. Right. So he's going to have to go.
You're there, Joe, but it'll stop. Look at me. I was like that.
So sorry if you want to let you know. He was just Joe LaCava said he found it, he was like saying afterwards to press, I hope he's not hurting, because in particular he struggled as the thing went on. LaCava had that slight worry, he said to media in a casual enough way. But I don't know, like, he started off well. He just seemed to have no energy. It was incredible, really.
There's a reason why Tiger's never won at Riviera. The primary one being is that he's never been that comfortable on those greens. On Saturday, he surrendered 5 shots to the field with his putter. Like, that's unheard of. Tiger Woods never does that.
Yeah,
never.
He said his putting was atrocious, actually.
But yeah, he also...
He said he's going to get back there and hit a gazillion putts.
But on Friday, he missed 6 greens from inside 150 yards. Like, again, like, Tiger doesn't miss greens from inside 150 yards. Mm. He was bad with the driver on Thursday. Like, all told, like, you can, and bad again on Sunday. Look, it's not as, maybe Tiger started, the argument that Tiger started well, but it's just he got tired because he's not putting out enough bulk. I'm not buying entirely, given that he played poorly from Thursday onwards. Right from the start, Tiger was nowhere. And look, he finished last in the field, which you can say, oh, well, you know, he kind of given up the ghost. And but when does Tiger ever give up the ghost?
When he's
Tiger battles to finish.
I
understand
he
all
was hosting
that. Absolutely.
Last week, though, wasn't he, as well? Yeah. So no doubt he had to go to X amount of functions and speak to X amount of people that he doesn't really want to speak to.
Listen, lads, he wasn't climbing Kilimanjaro. I'm just saying, like, you know.
I know, but when you get these guys out of their comfort zone, it takes a lot out of them.
Sorry, I'm not suggesting that...
I said that sarcastically, by the way.
That physically Tiger wasn't knackered, but, you know, just losing five strokes to the field with his putter, oh, my God.
Yeah, his distance...
I don't know.
Some of his putts went so far long and came up so short at times, it was...
Yeah,
it was almost so bad. I've no worries about it. Like,
yeah, maybe
it was just so terrible. It was just a complete anomaly.
At least Tiger didn't top a drive on the 10th when he was in the lead.
Yeah, the golf coverage has come in for a lot of flack. Actually, it's been a bad week for CBS. They didn't show much at all, really.
So Harold Varner, he was two behind the leaders, and with nine to play, he was tied at the top. Now, Harold Varner III is not a regular winner on the PGA Tour, so pressure, you want to talk about the kind of pressure that you were talking about, I'm sure Mr. Varner was feeling it, but
he's a little drive junkie, though, isn't he? Sorry for interrupting you, but he seems to be on the leaderboard and then just disappear when the pressure
disappears. So clearly, maybe he needs to take a look and analyze with cold, hard facts on why he keeps disappearing. But on the 10th, stood up, hit a drive 129 yards. And the only thing we saw was his caddy measuring from 180 yards behind everybody else. And you're like, what? What's going on? They didn't show the shot for 75 minutes.
Mm.
And so I had, now I'm going to, I'd love to tell you that I had like two eyes firmly on the golf. I didn't. I had the golf on and I was kind of doing some work. But you know, I was watching. And Harold Varner would not be a player that would automatically make me jump to attention. But the fact that he was in the lead, I was like, what? Why is this? And they were like, oh, apparently he didn't hit. And you're like, lads, show the shot. But as Peter Costas was asked this on the No Laying Up pod, and he goes, probably didn't have cameras there. And you're like, what? Like, what do you mean? They didn't have cameras on the drives of the leaders on the 10th? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, well, he was saying there's been serious cutbacks. He said they've laid off award-winning cameramen, experienced, who know where to be and why at given moments in the round. And also, the exact quote he had was, from the bottom of my heart, I believe this. No one in management of a network or at the leadership of the PGA Tour gives a rat's ass about the quality of the telecast. They don't care about the quality of the viewer experience. They don't care about anything other than promotion. They are interested in the marketing of the product. So he was talking about how CBS are a public company. They have to make money. So they got, you know, the PGA Tour all over them to give FedEx lots of mentions and show lots of FedEx leaderboards. They have to show a ton of ads. They have to go to the corporate guy and do the interview with the CEOs. They have corporate marketing. They have a gazillion different things, and that's why they don't show as much golf. And they've cut back on some of the staff. And that is why on Sky Sports then, when we're at the far end of it, almost after every shot, they cut to the putting green. Did you notice that?
Yeah.
Over here?
Yeah.
It's just they cut to the putting green, or that's because on CBS, I presume, they're gone to another ad break or they're gone to something.
Yeah.
Or else they cut to the shot of the clubhouse. It was, now, oftentimes they went back very quickly to the action, but it was like a cutaway always to the clubhouse. So I don't think they had a good day, CBS.
I think I said, I wasn't on last week, but I think I said the week prior about what has to happen in golf. For people to retain watching it.
Mm.
And the coverage really, really has to improve.
It does.
It really has to improve. Like, stop spending this millions or zillions that they're spending and paying the tours and actually work out a deal that is going to, you know, instead of giving that money to the tour, use that money to promote a product that is actually enjoyable to watch. And you're seeing lots of different shots, and you're seeing guys who are on the cut line, and you know, are they going to make it, are they not? Make it exciting on Friday as it is exciting on Sunday. You know, one is, you know, detriment to their careers, and the other one is all about, you know, the cash at the end of the day. But they need more cameras out there, they need more coverage, they need more you know, interviews and stuff like that. You know, make it interesting.
It's so expensive.
It's very expensive.
But it is very expensive. I totally agree with you. But wouldn't it be much better to employ a whole lot more people than hand over gazillions to the tour and the tour go, we're dying here, help. You know?
But Peter, the counter argument to that, and I absolutely agree with you. I mean, everything you've said is 100% true. But the counter argument, if I was a CBS or a Golf Channel executive, would be the PGA are charging us through the nose for the rights to broadcast this, and our market share is 2.8. You know, people are switching off golf to watch the NBA or the NFL or whatever other big sporting event is on. This is like, our bottom line is we can't justify spending 150 million. Whatever it is, I'm just picking a arbitrary number.
I mean, but instead of spending that, come to the tour and go, right, instead of saying, we're going to give you 150 million, we're going to put 150 million into the telecast. And it's actually going to highlight how good your product is.
Peter Costas's point is exactly that, as Joe read out, they don't give a rat's ass about the quality of the thing. All they care is about promoting the thing. And so, you know, that seems like a perennial issue.
Yeah, well, it was very noticeable on Sunday because it was such a brilliant tournament, and there was a part of me thinking, this should be even a bit better.
Yeah.
And I kept seeing a certain name on the leaderboard, and I was like, oh, I forgot he was there.
Yeah.
So anyway, we got to get out of here. Premier League's attempt at world domination, major blow with the Rory McIlroy intervention. So he basically said, not for me. I am not interested.
Yeah.
And he gave a few reasons. He wanted autonomy. He wanted to be on the right side of history. He didn't like the fact that if you know, they pay you the money, they can tell you what to do. And for all those reasons, not for him. And somebody said to him, well, you know, Tiger seemed to be kind of open to it. And it was kind of, you know, it was amazing, really, Rory. Most players there would have said, oh, well, I can't speak for Tiger. Rory was like, well, you know, Tiger, is he going to play 18 events and four majors and he's got two kids? Like he said, he only wants to play 12 times a year. And he just went, Tiger's not going to do it. It was brilliant. Yeah. You know, it was great.
Yeah,
it was like, well,
the answer.
Exactly. This Tiger's clearly not going to do it. And here's why. Yeah. I'd say Steinberg on the phone to Rory's people going, what are you doing? We're using this as leverage. Will you shut up?
Exactly.
But so that, I mean, on the at the upper tier, which is Tiger and Rory, that looks like, at the moment, they're not going to move, if we take Rory's point on Tiger to be true, which seemed very convincing. The rumours, you know, depending on who you're listening to, Noel Lane-Up even mentioned this, the rumours certainly were that Mickelson was always going to be announced, unveiled as the first guy to move over, and names that had been mentioned as being open to it included Koepka, DJ, Reed, maybe even Justin Rose a little bit, Steinberg, his agent, so it's hard to know if they're playing some kind of game, Steinberg's people. But I don't know, like, if you don't have Rory and you don't have Tiger, you may have to approach it from the back end, as in, well, maybe the initial plan might have been, if we get the world's top five, we're rocking here. They may now have to go, we need to get 25 of the world's top 35, and then Rory and Tiger and the rest will have to come and play. So I don't know what their strategy is now, but Rory saying that is a big blow. That's the world number one.
I certainly wouldn't be investing any of my own money into this company because I really don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah. Fionn, that kind of halts it in its tracks a little bit. What do you think?
Not so sure. We'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see. I mean, I'm perplexed. I mean, maybe it's that Rory, who has shown consistent form in this, he doesn't take Saudi money. So he obviously has taken an ethical stance because obviously the Saudis are one of the major investors in the PGL. So when he says, I want to be on the right side of history, he's saying, look, I don't want to be part of a league that's funded with so-called dirty money from a petrostate that that has huge question marks over its human rights record, et cetera, et cetera. However, if you read the statement very carefully, he leaves the door a tiny bit open. There is always the possibility of amending the offer. So look, if they amended the offer and addressed some of the golfing concerns, then, you know, who knows? Maybe down the line, he might be tempted. And I think if what if the PGL said to Tiger, is like, oh, no, no, you don't have to play more than 12 times.
Yeah, well, that is possible. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
listen,
for sure.
I says, look, Rory McIlroy obviously threw a major spanner in the hypothetical works of the PGL, because that's all it is at the moment. But, you know, if these guys are really serious about it and the PGA is having the issues that it's having that we've talked about for the last hour and change, who the hell knows? Who the hell knows? I think there's plenty of room for negotiation.
It's true. Okay, hour and change is the key point there. Let's get out of here, really. Graeme McDowell is at a WGC in Mexico for the first time since 2016 at a WGC. Shane Lowry's there. He's had a bit of a break. He said, I wouldn't be overly optimistic this week, but I never usually am. It's great, isn't it? He literally takes every rule, every rule, and just says, I'm going to break it. I'll do it my way. He says, I'm trying to come in under the radar, do my thing for the week. Hopefully I can pop up on the leaderboard come Saturday afternoon, and I'll give it a run on Sunday. Like, in a way, what a lovely way to approach it, you know, pressure-free. We have no fewer than three of the world's top 10 not going. Brooks Koepka, Tiger Woods, Patrick Cantlay not going. Justin Rose, Ricky Fowler, Tony Finau, Henrik Stenson not going. So that's a really poor turnout for the WGC. Rory is playing with Tommy Fleetwood and Gary Woodland. Rory is the favourite. Dustin Johnson is there at 6-1. John Rahm 10-1. Justin Thomas is there 10-1. I will, of course, be cheering on 16-1 Adam Scott. Peter.
I like that pause.
Also there is Webb Simpson, a one-time proponent of the much-loved long stick. We have Hideki Matsuyama, Xander Schauffele, Tommy Fleetwood, Bryson DeChambeau.
Hideki is coming back to your mate. Hideki is certainly playing decent golf.
I gave him a call. I offered a few thoughts.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good.
So,
pro-am to no doubt in Matt Juliet. And Hideki.
Are you enjoying Ireland? Uh-huh. you can't forget each other after a conversation
absolutely
like that.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's kind of it there.
Yeah.
So I like this tournament because the ball goes a gazillion miles at altitude.
Okay.
It's hilarious. Right. So par four, 400 yards, drive the green.
Drive flick.
Not even a flick.
Okay.
Drive and putt. So that is us done. Fionn, thanks so much. I know it was a long one. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. And Peter Lowry, now back to the world's finest driving range in Spawell. Thanks very much, Peter.
No problem. Thank you.
Cheers. That's us done. We'll talk to you next week. Good luck.